This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. On this week's episode, we're going to be hearing from number one best-selling author Peter Dove to talk about the new edition of his book, Master Dressage. And we'll also be hearing from Dr. Stephen Reed later on in the program in our continuing series on the neurological disease EPM. And we would like to remind you that the views of the host and guests on this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of USDF or its members. And we begin with the news of the US Equestrian Federation's para-equestrian team for this year's Paralympic Games. The four named riders are Sydney Collier from Ann Arbor, Michigan, riding Wesley Dunham's Western Rose in Grade 1B, Rebecca Hart from Wellington, Florida, riding her own Schroeter's Romani in Grade 2, Margaret McIntosh from Reading, Pennsylvania, and her own Rio Rio in the Grade 1A, and Annie Peavy from Avon, Connecticut and Wellington, Florida, rides Heather Blitz and Rebecca Reno's Lancelot Warrior in the Grade 3 class. There is more information on the US Paralympic Equestrian Team selection process on their website at usef.org. All nominations to the 2016 US Paralympic Team are subject to approval by the United States Olympic Committee. And our first guest this week is Peter Dove, the author of Master Dressage. For more than 25 years, Peter has been riding, teaching, and learning dressage. He's coached by Mary Wanless and considers her teachings of rider biomechanics to be one of the main keys to success at all levels of riding. Well, Peter joins us now from the UK, where he's based. Peter, welcome to the programme.
Thank you for having me.
So, tell us a little bit about your background, Peter, to start off with. Let's introduce you to our wider audience here in the US and a snapshot, if you would, of your career in dressage.
Well, I've been riding since about the age of 18. So I kind of took up riding as an adult. You know, I came from a town, really. So never really got introduced to horses until I met a girlfriend who rode. And, you know, I started to learn to ride as well. I initially was quite interested in racing because I was quite small. I'm 5'8", and I think at the time I was something like 9 stone. So, you know, I was interested in that, but apparently I had to learn to ride properly before I could do the racing. So I started taking my BHS exams and actually really became interested in dressage at that point, in just, you know, building up my skill set in riding. So I took my BHS exams, I moved through a number of yards learning, and then eventually I met Mary Wanless, the author of the Ride of the Mind books, and that's really when I started getting, you know, really interested in dressage, really interested in improving myself and getting better results from the horses. But not long after that, I actually started work in IT, and, you know, eventually that kind of eclipsed what I was able to do with horses, you know, just the basics of trying to live. Not too far in the future, I met my current wife, so that's kind of like 17 years ago now, and we both moved in together to the equestrian center that we've been running for that long. And, you know, ever since then, we've been riding, doing a little bit of competition. And, you know, the center runs dressage almost every weekend, every single month of the year. And I do a significant amount of judging. So, you know, I was trying to work out over the last 16 years how many tests I judged at the lower level. And, you know, it came out to something like over 15,000 dressage tests at intro, prelim, and novice, which I think is kind of intro training level one for the US.
Well, that leads us very nicely to the very topic of your book, Master Dressage: Ride More Beautiful Tests, Get Higher Marks, and Have a Better Relationship with Your Horse. All of those things, that's quite a wide-ranging topic, though, isn't it, Peter? What inspired you to actually pen this book in the first place?
Well, you know, I think it was just judging all of those tests and helping riders over all those years. You know, every single dressage competition that I would judge at, I would see the same typical mistakes. And those mistakes could be accuracy mistakes, or they could be mistakes where the rider doesn't really understand what it is the judge is wanting to see from a particular test. You know, and you would often see riders battling through a test and you know, finish an unhappy horse and an unhappy rider. So I wanted to put together a book that would address all of those kind of issues. And you know, you would often see riders making mistakes in accuracy, which would make the test harder for their horse than it actually needs to be. So, you know, that's why I came to write the book. And, you know, I sort of really worked hard to come together for a system, a framework with which riders could learn to, you know, master dressage themselves. I think, you know, the title might sound as though I was trying to get someone to become a master at dressage, but I wanted them to learn how to master dressage. I wanted to give them a framework with which they could approach learning dressage and become better at it.
Well, let's start with riding accurate tests. Give us an overview of what you were aiming for with that chapter, Peter.
With accuracy, there's quite a few different aspects to it. The first aspect of it is really just understanding the geometry of the arena, the geometry of all the different movements in the test, and, you know, how to ride those accurately. A lot of it, too, is when riders are riding movements, they're often creating too much bend, or they're making decisions on transitions or turning, which are making the job harder for the horse. For an example, here's a really basic example, but the number of riders that I see making a turn, let's say up the center line at A, where they have to turn left if you're in an indoor arena, they ride right up to the marker and then turn as if somehow they believe a horse can do a 90-degree turn. And, you know, it's the same with their corners. You know, they're trying to ride the horse into the corners, but pushing it onto the outside shoulder and so on. So, you know, I really wanted to break down how to ride accurately, but at the appropriate level for the horse that the person was riding.
Let's talk about, you know, part of riding an accurate test is to be fluid through all the transitions and the movements throughout the test. And that was another topic that you addressed.
Yeah, you know, one of the examples that I use in there is how to move from one movement to the next. So, for instance, if you're going large and you have to move on to a circle, at the lower levels, you'll often see a rider ride up to the marker and then the horse kind of, you know, fall in and make the turn or perhaps fall out. One of the things about fluidity is preparation. So, you know, if you're about to turn right or you're about to make a circle to the right just before you make the turn, you want to create a little bit of bend and then start the horse off on the turn. Another part of fluidity as well is in transitions, and especially with upward transitions. You know, I would always rather see a horse make a very smooth transition from walk to trot, remain round, stay in the same outline, you know, and push off from its hind legs, rather than a really quick transition where a horse lengthens its underneath and lifts its head and kind of speeds off into trot. So, you know, I think fluidity is part smoothness and part preparation too. Preparation for the movement and also understanding how to move from one movement to the next as well. So positioning of the horse, if you like.
Right. And as a judge, you know what you want to see, and it's getting the riders to understand what the dressage wants, what the judge wants to see. So that is another topic that you address, to actually better understand what the movements are and what you're presenting.
Yeah, you know, sometimes you see, I had this actually last weekend when I was writing for a judge. You're watching people compete and it's quite clear to you as a judge that they don't understand what it is that you're looking for from a particular movement. So in that chapter, I cover typical rider mistakes. So, you know, one of those things that I cover is actually the understanding of what bend really is and an understanding about how to have the horse maintain its balance on a circle or a turn. But I cover other things such as shoving with the seat or using too much hand and so on. But I also cover the scales of training so that the rider can understand the progression of the horse. I cover the judge's perspective. So, you know, we talk about things like what does the judge want to see in stretching? What does the judge want to see in transitions? And also what the judge's comments mean. You know, the judges have lots of different ways of saying the same thing. For instance, a judge could say, needs more suppleness. And that particular phrase might mean your horse needs more suppleness. It might mean that, for instance, you need to present your horse with more suppleness. You know, often I see riders doing turns and circles and they don't prepare the horse sufficiently well, or they overbend the horse to the inside, for instance, and what they're presenting is an unbalanced horse, but actually the horse is quite capable of presenting a supple test. So it's not always that the horse needs to be more supple, but the horse needs to be presented more correctly to look more supple. An example might be, for instance, back to the turning up the center line. You know, if you wait too late and then suddenly turn your horse up the center line, it can look unbalanced, and the judge might write, unbalanced needs more suppleness. Whereas if you were to start your turn a little bit further back and take a slightly bigger arc, your horse could move more balanced and you know, it would actually look more supple to the judge than if you just winged it round the corner. So, yeah, there's a lot to actually understand in dressage, both from the judge's perspective and what's required of all the different movements. So, yeah, big chapter.
Yes, I'm sure, a very fat chapter, but also the training element too. You know, what you should actually be practicing to break down those movements and focusing on and being prepared for when things do go wrong. You address that in some detail too.
Yeah, I think practice is broken down into lots of different areas. I mean, one element of practice is the rider learning to have enough focus. You know, I often think that riders don't focus enough when they ride. An example, for instance, is just typical on, say, circles. You know, a rider will start their circle and it looks like they kind of switch off, like they expect the horse to complete the circle by itself. And then, you know, 6 or 7 strides later, the horse is drifting out through the outside shoulder and they're having to suddenly make these corrections. Whereas the right level of focus from moment to moment and treating a 20-meter circle as a series of discrete steps, the rider gets a much more accurate and fluid-looking circle because of their level of focus. So I do talk about focus. I think one of the sections is called What's Going On Inside Your Head, which is, you know, a discussion about how you think and the critical voice inside your head. There are other elements to practice, such as if you come across certain problems when you're training your horse, you know, I talk about having fallback points. You know, if you find that your skill level can't solve a particular problem, such as, for instance, hollowing and downward transitions or upward transitions or so on, what other things that you can do, maybe off horse or on the ground or through lunging, that will help solve that problem for you?
And then, of course, you're taking this to the arena and put it all into practice, all that practice into practice. And
yes,
then taking the comments home and dissecting the judges' comments. That is something, you know, people take very sensitively, don't they? Because it is very personal.
Yeah, it is very, very personal. I think what most people can do is always make sure they video the test. And, you know, I mean, I don't know. From person to person, it's very, very different. But I often see people pick up a sheet, scan through it, and that's the end of that sort of discussion, if you like. They scan through and go, oh, yeah, and then off they go. Whereas I think there needs to be a bigger amount of focus on review, on how you review each of the movements, on how you understand what the judge's comments, for instance. You know, you ought to be watching that video back, movement by movement, and having a look at the judge's comments as well. And actually, I think I put it was a fairly large table in there, which actually went through a whole load of questions that you can ask yourself as you watch that video back. And I think anyone who looks at that table will realize that I tend to think in a lot more detail when I'm doing a review than most people do. And I think that review is really, really important because, you know, by doing that kind of review, you can say, do I need to be more accurate? Do I need to have more fluidity? Is there a lack of understanding in the requirements of the movements? Am I not understanding what the judge is wanting here? How can I solve that issue? Do I need to change my practice? Do I need to practice something more, something less? Do I need to change what I'm doing when I'm warming the horse in or when I'm practicing at home? So, you know, review works backwards through all of those previous chapters, through all those previous steps.
An awful lot of detail in there, Peter, but how would you summarize what your philosophy is behind this book and what you would like readers to take away from it?
I think my philosophy about dressage really is that it requires an awful lot of study in a lot of different areas from riders. It's quite a big task because not only do you need to improve your riding and the mechanics by which you ride, you need to understand training of the horse, you need to understand what the judges want to see from you, what the requirements of dressage are. You know, it takes a lot of focus from the rider. My philosophy around training is much more around patience, you know, patience with yourself and patience with the horse as well. So, you know, that's an important theme through the book.
A five-step system in how to master dressage, and as you say, broken down into bite-sized pieces, Peter, what would you say would be your final message to the USDF members here about why they should buy your book, given the detail that you've included there?
Well, you know, I think by buying this book, it will actually give you a plan as to how to go forwards to improve your dressage. So you will become better at learning. You'll understand what it is you need to learn, what it is you need to focus on, and, you know, lots of techniques to be able to go away and learn things. I mean, nobody learns just by themselves, but to learn efficiently and to have a better relationship with your horse, you need to have a strategy to improve your learning. You have to really understand all the different elements that you need to work on to be better at dressage.
All right. And your book was published in 2015. It's available in the USDF bookstore to any listeners out there, any USDF members, and of course our wider audience. Peter, thank you very much indeed for coming on the program and telling us about your book.
Thank you very much.
And you can preview a chapter of Peter's book, Master Dressage, on the website by visiting eTrack. Trafalgar Square Books generously provided a sample chapter on 10-metre circles and related figures to share with USDF members. The USDF members can also get a 10% discount on this book and other items carried in the USDF store. There'll be a direct link in the show notes accompanying this episode to that website page. And coming up next in our Vet Connections segment, we'll hear part two of the discussion on EPM. This conversation is an extension of the article in the June edition of the USDF Connection magazine entitled EPM, Not Just Playing Possum. The USDF Senior Education Coordinator, Sharon van der Zeel, sat down with equine neurological disease expert Dr. Stephen Reed from Rudin Riddle in Lexington, Kentucky.
So what is the current treatment protocol for EPM if a horse is diagnosed positive? Or like you said, in some cases, I think sometimes they just start treatment.
That's right. A lot of people will use treatment as their diagnostic test. So they'll look for a response to medication. So at this time, there are three FDA-approved medications for the treatment of EPM. The first is a product called Rebalance. Rebalance is a combination of pyrimethamine, an anti-malarial drug, and sulfadiazine, an antibiotic. Both of these drugs act by inhibiting folic acid. So they inhibit dihydrofolate reductase. So they're going to inhibit folic acid, and they're going to have a damaging effect to the protozoan. The important thing that I'm going to mention about that drug is they can also have that effect on the horse. So you need to use that drug carefully, not overdose it, and you need to use it for an appropriate time period. Now, it's relatively safe. So many horses that go on rebalance will be treated for 120 days. So it's not, I don't want anybody to get the idea that that it's a terribly dangerous drug. Although, you know, when administered at 20 times use level, there has been one report of some death in horses. So it is important. The next two drugs, one is called Panaziril, and its trade name is Marquis. Marquis is they're a triazine derived drug, and these drugs affect a number of parts of the protozoan, but there's one little part of the protozoan called an apicoplast that is sort of a conserved, evolutionarily conserved thing, because drugs like the triazines, you might think of a drug like atrazine, which is used on the treatment of a field, you know, corn and other agents. But these will affect the protozoan and will, in fact, inhibit or kill the organism. And that drug, Marquis, has been around for quite some time. Key things about Marquis are it's most effective when given as a loading dose on day one. So the usual dose is 5 milligrams per kilogram. The loading dose is 15 milligrams per kilogram. So you give it 3 times the use level on day one, then you switch to 5 milligrams per kilogram. It's a 28-day course. The third drug is marketed as Protozil. Protozil is diclazoril, so another in the similar class to the Panaziril. And that particular drug comes as an alfalfa pellet. So it's in a pelleted ration that you can use to feed the horses, and then they will it will have an effect. Its effective dose is at 1 milligram per kilogram. The company that manufactures it has recently done a study at 0.5 milligram per kilogram and shown that it took a little longer to get effective levels in the blood and CSF, but that it was still very effective. And all of these drugs, we also want to make sure they'll get good levels in the tissues, because the protozoan organism is going to get inside the nerve cells. And so we need to kill it where it's where it resides. Those are the drugs that are out there. There are many other drugs that people will ask me about on a regular basis. And I don't know, is it, we can talk about some of those. One of them is called Bacox or Toltrazoril. Toltrazoril is a drug that is one time passed through the liver, it becomes Panaziril. So it ends up being the same product, you know, effectively as the Marquis. Since Marquis is an FDA-approved product, that is the drug that we recommend. Beyond that, there's some work going on another antiprotozoal called Decoquinate. And the Decoquinate is used to treat coccidia in calves and chicken, poultry, and other species. So it's an antiprotozoal drug. And I think there is some work being done now with the FDA to look at the potential for that drug to be approved.
And that's good news.
Yeah.
Do they generally use these like in combination? I know sometimes if there's a relapse situation or something, they may switch medications, or is that something that you recommend, or does it just depend on the case?
Yeah, that does. It does depend on the case and the veterinarian. Okay, so routinely I choose one drug and I stick with that. But there are many veterinarians that I have great respect for who will use a combination of therapies. So they will start with maybe the either Protozil or Panaziril, and they will combine it with the pyrimethamine sulfadiazine. So they're going to attack the protozoan from multiple directions. The one drug they're going to use for the 28, or maybe they'll run 2 months of that, 28 day to 2 months of the either Diclazeril or Panaziril, so Marquis or Protozil, and then they'll continue on with the rebalance. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people will do that. Some will have both drugs on together. In addition to that, other people like to try to enhance the immune system. And so for that, some people, and I'm one of these, will also add levamisole for a period of time anywhere from 10 to 14 to the full 28 days. So again, that particular product has a couple of things that are important to remember about it. Number one, it shouldn't be used in an excessive dosing. So I usually dose it at 5 milligrams per kilogram, but some people go as low as 1 milligram per kilogram. Probably up to 10 would be safe, but again, you don't want to overdo that particular medication. In addition, that medication is metabolized into some agents that are stimulants. So it's probably going to be on the FEI forbidden list, as it maybe are all the anti-protozoal drugs, you know, at this point in time. So I'd say if you've got a horse that has neurologic disease severe enough, it's not going to be competing anyway. But if it's a very mildly affected case, then be sure to check the rules and regulations for the use of these medications.
Yeah, very good. So what type of lifestyle do you normally recommend for a horse recovering from EPM?
So I like for all horses with neurologic disease, once they are able, I like them to stay in a little bit of work. So if there's any concern that they might fall, that work should be done with no rider up. So, you know, there's nothing more critical than the safety of the rider, because there isn't a horse made that's worth somebody getting hurt over. Having said that, depending on the severity, you may not be able to exercise these horses. You heard me mention one little while ago that 6 days after we had done blocking on it and thought it was just a very obscure neuro or a lameness problem, it was recumbent and it couldn't get up without the use of a sling for, it was almost a month before that horse could get up and down on its own without difficulty and move on. So I think the severity of signs in the case are going to determine what sort of level of exercise the horse can have. And early on, I like him to have maybe just turn out into a small paddock or a little pasture. And then eventually, it's really critical to get him back in work. Because with neurologic disease, rehabilitation is very, very critical.
Okay, that's good to know. Are there any activities, again, I'm sure it depends on symptoms, but that a recovering horse should avoid, like hill work or fast turns or, you know, certain things like that?
Yes, probably of the ones that you mentioned, the fast turns would be really, really critical. I think you need to work a lot on their balance and coordination. And the owner plays a huge role in the successful outcome of any neurologic problem, not just EPM, because rehabilitation is so absolutely critical. Getting the horse back to exercising. One of the things that we now know, in this was some work done by the people at Colorado State on orthopedic injuries, is that if you do an aquatread, that improves proprioception, awareness of where the feet are. So putting them in an aquatread can be helpful. If you want to improve strength, working them uphill on a treadmill or outside uphill, but you also keyed in on it. Safety first. So whatever level of work the horse can accommodate, that's what it should do. Believe it or not, going downhills, it will actually, when the horse gets going faster, that works on their sort of balance and coordination because they have to move real quickly to get their feet there. But strength, uphill work, downhill maybe for balance and coordination. Once that they're starting to recover, I like to put them over ground poles or Cavalletti. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I will also then start them into figure of eights and a lot of things. Rehabilitation is key.
Okay, so probably like maybe lots of transitions too for like a dressage horse especially.
Absolutely. Yeah. For dressage horse transitions, yeah, would be really important. And even, believe it or not, with neurologic cases, even race horses that we have, that no matter what their underlying problem is, whether they had EPM or were a true wobbler, if they're coming back from a neurologic problem, we actually have sent them to dressage trainers because it really helps the horse to gain balance and strength. And I think that's a really important aspect of it.
Great. Do you suggest any supplements or alternative medicine treatments like acupuncture or anything like that during the recovery period?
So I've already mentioned levamisole. That's something I use as an adjunct to the treatment. And there may be other immune stimulants that would be helpful because we wonder about why, if so many horses are infected, and yet so very few develop the neurologic form of the disease, it may be that most of the time the horse's immune system blocks the organism from getting into the nervous system. And that's true whether it be for the Neospora or for the sarcocystis. Beyond that, I'm not trained in acupuncture, but I know that a lot of people use this, and there's certainly some evidence that it will have a benefit for regeneration of nerves. I just reviewed a paper on a horse that had loss of tail tone, in which they used acupuncture as a part of the therapy, and it seemed to have some benefit. So I do think that, you know, that modality may be of benefit. Again, if you're going to do that, you need to go to someone trained in that area.
So, in closing, what are the three main things that you would like our listeners to know about EPM?
I think the three most important things that I could say are, number one, this disease is still here. It's not gone away. And I think it's important to know that there are two organisms, both the Sarcocystis neurona and the Neospora husi, as causes of this. They're both protozoans. They have a little bit different life cycles, but nonetheless, they're important organisms. The other thing is accuracy of diagnosis is tremendously enhanced by use of CSF. And not just the CSF titer alone, but the ratio of antibody in blood to CSF. And whether you use the IFAT test or whether you use an ELISA test, whatever test you use, I think it's important to do the ratio between blood to CSF. And then the last thing is that to know that there are many good treatments for this disease and that we recommend the FDA-approved products, but that in some instances there may be new drugs coming down the road. Let's hope there are. And so I think those are probably if I can have a fourth,
you can have a fourth.
Rehabilitation is important as well. When a horse gets over a neurologic problem, probably the biggest headache from this disease is if you have a horse that gets substantial muscle atrophy by damage to the nerves where they're coming off the spinal cord, so they're in those segments of the spinal cord that are providing peripheral nerves, that may not come back. And so a horse might end up recovering from the EPM, but have two things, a blemish, because it's going to have muscle wasting, and that might cause a loss of strength in that particular region. So if that's all the gluteal muscles on one side, your horse may not be able to go back and do all the maneuvers that it could before.
And you think the early rehabilitation could help prevent that?
No doubt. And the other thing that can help there, in addition to the acupuncture that we talked about, is the use of maybe transcutaneous electrical stimulation, so the TENS unit. Mm-hmm. Because if you keep the muscles firing, that will maintain their integrity until the nerve supply can regenerate.
Okay.
So that's an important thing.
All right. Well, thank you very much again for joining us. I think that was very educational. I hope you'll come back and keep us up to date if there's any new treatments or diagnosis things that we need to know about.
I'd love to. I enjoy the opportunity to be here. Thank you for asking me.
And finally, this week, the USDF would like to remind artists that the deadline for the 2016 USDF Arts Contest is July the 1st. This annual contest was designed to highlight the creativity and beauty of dressage and to allow USDF members to express their interest in the sport outside of the competition arena. Winners will have their work published in the yearbook issue of USDF Connection magazine, with the grand prize winner used as the cover of the USDF member guide. All submissions must be the work of a current USDF member, and there's a direct link to more information and the entry form on the USDF's homepage at usdf.org. And finally, a reminder that you can subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes Podcast Store or Stitcher or any other smartphone app. You can follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook for alerts when new episodes will become available. Until the next time, thank you for listening wherever you are in the world. And remember, the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.